Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is the third in the series on social entrepreneurship. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club and your moderator. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker tonight, Ms. Sally Osberg. As president and CEO of the Skoll Foundation, Sally has been a major presence in shaping the field of social entrepreneurship. Her vision and that of the Skoll Foundation has greatly influenced the growth of social entrepreneurship in the United States and around the world. A leader in the social sector for more than 25 years, she was formerly executive director of the Children's Discovery Museum of San Jose, which she guided from its inception to national recognition. Sally has held adjunct faculty positions at Hamilton College and Utica College of Syracuse University, where she was also co-director of the Writing Center. She earned her MA in Literature from Claremont Graduate School and her BA in English from Scripps College. In 1998, she received the John Gardner Leadership Award from the American Leadership Forum, and in 1999, the San Jose Mercury News named her one of the Millennium 100 and recognized her as one of the key individuals who have shaped and led Silicon Valley. No small feat. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sally Osberg.
Thanks, Ruth, for that kind introduction and for your leadership in creating this landmark series for the Commonwealth Club on social entrepreneurship. It's an honor for me to be one of the speakers you've brought together. Among the 13 folks you've assembled are several Skoll social entrepreneurs and partners, folks we've been really privileged to support, people like Muhammad Yunus and Mary Houghton, Bill Drayton, Jacqueline Novogratz, Premal Shaw, Willie Foote, extraordinary human beings and exemplary social entrepreneurs. Now, most of you are here because you're interested in this genus we know is the social entrepreneur. But before we go there, I'd like to take you down a sidetrack. Not just any sidetrack, but a flat track. The kind preferred by serious motorcycle racers. People like Barry and Andrea Coleman. Just this last week, these two iconic bikers, who also happen to be iconic social entrepreneur founders of Riders for Health, visited with us in our offices in Palo Alto, where they explained just what flat track racing had to do with social entrepreneurship. Now, I suspect that, like me, few of you had ever heard of flat track racing, which is to serious bikers the most primal, authentic, and thrilling form of competition. Harkening back to the origins of the sport at the turn of the century, the track itself is dirt, it's compassed that classic oval shape, and the motorcycles make 20 or so laps around during the course of a race. As they roar around the track, the bikes gradually wear a groove where you'd expect to find it, near the center and hugging the inside. Along the outside, the kicked up dirt and dust forms what's known as the cushion, a far riskier place to ride for obvious reasons. The dirt is soft, traction uncertain. Social entrepreneurs, Barry explained to us, ride in that cushion. No grooves, plenty of potential to slip and slide out of control, plenty of guts and determination required. Now, just in case you might be thinking social entrepreneurs like the Colemans are daredevils, let me assure you that they're as disciplined as they are determined. Taking to the cushion requires confidence in your experience, your skill, and the condition of your motorcycle, which must be impeccably maintained. Oil, gas, gears, engine, down to knowing the depths of the treads in your tires till the millimeter. If there's anything I want you to take away from this talk, it's that social entrepreneurs are entrepreneurs. Every bit as focused, disciplined, creative, courageous, and hard-driving as, yes, Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, even more so. To underscore the point, think about that famous dancing duo, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. I know. What's she doing now? First motorcycling and now ballroom dancing. Stay with me. To me, the social entrepreneur is to the entrepreneur what Ginger Rogers is to Fred Astaire, because social entrepreneurs have to do everything that entrepreneurs do, but backwards and in high heels. Social entrepreneurs see and seize opportunities just as entrepreneurs do, but they must plan each step forward without financial services or venture capitalists to back them. Social entrepreneurs, like all successful entrepreneurs, combine a predisposition to action with rigorous business planning. Even though they can't aim at anything as definitive as a liquidation event, they must convincingly articulate where they're headed and the social impact they'll achieve. Most also will carry out their strategies by building ventures, which require boards to govern, cash to pay the bills, and organizations of talented, highly motivated folks to do the heavy lifting. No stock options, though, to lure them. In what follows, I'm going to share with you how the Skoll Foundation came to focus on social entrepreneurs, what we've done over our first decade of work to help them scale their impact, a bit about what we've learned along the way, and where we're headed. 10 years ago, I'd never heard the term social entrepreneur, and neither had Jeff Skoll. But in late 2000, when Jeff invited me to serve as his foundation's first CEO, he knew that he wanted us to seek out and back a certain kind of leader, people with entrepreneurial solutions to social and environmental problems. As I met and got to know Jeff, what I saw was someone of that same stripe, an entrepreneur prepared to bring his creativity, his business savvy, his razor-sharp mind, and driving determination to address societal challenges with his philanthropy. A serial entrepreneur, in fact, Jeff had already started two companies by the time he joined Pierre Omidyar as eBay's first president. Jeff's first real foray into philanthropy was his creation of the eBay Foundation, which he did in a decidedly entrepreneurial way, dedicating pre-IPO shares of eBay stock to seed an endowment that soared to $35 million after the company went public in 97. Jeff then ran the eBay Foundation so that by the time he'd launched the Skoll Foundation 2 years later, he developed a real bias for folks with exciting visions, proven track records, and credible plans for making big dents on big issues. Shortly after joining Jeff, I arranged for us to meet together with one of my mentors, John Gardner. John was advisor to 5 U.S. presidents, architect of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, founder of Common Cause, and fairly early in his career, head of a foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, where, among other accomplishments, he commissioned the report that led to creation of the Public Broadcasting Service. I could think of no one wiser to counsel us, so I held my breath as Jeff asked John just how to go about making as much of a difference with his foundation as possible. John's answer was deceptively simple. Bet on good people doing good things, he told us. It's advice that affirmed we were on the right track. Our first mission, actually, was to invest in those with the greatest potential to make lasting positive change to their communities and the world. Even though we both knew we had work to do in getting clear about just who those good people were and how to evaluate the good they proposed to do. Once we learned there was a neater description for the kind of good people we were attracted to and already supporting, people in organizations like Bill Strickland and his Manchester Craftsman's Guild, or Nick Moon and Martin Fisher of Apertech, now Kickstart, that they were known as social entrepreneurs, and that, in fact, organizations like Ashoka had been at this for some time, we knew the responsible thing to do was look at what was needed and how we could contribute. That led us to undertake a process of market analysis with someone who's become a good friend, Noah Manduk, who's here tonight, and who actually now is Chief Strategy Officer for the Jeff Skoll Group. What Noah helped us figure out was that Ashoka was focused on early-stage social entrepreneurs, and I know you're going to be hearing from Bill Drayton, so he'll tell you Ashoka's amazing story. Echo and Green on emerging social entrepreneurs. Acumen Fund, and again, you're going to hear from Jacqueline, they were looking at potentially profitable social enterprises. But no one was homing in on social entrepreneurs at a mezzanine stage, when arguably leverage could be greatest. We also discovered that social entrepreneurship was very much a niche in the larger space of societal change-making, and not really yet on the policy, media, or philanthropic radar. Putting all of this together, we saw great opportunity to go deep by seeking out and backing the highest potential social entrepreneurs we could find, and to go broad by building the field of social entrepreneurship. Thinking more like a social entrepreneur, which was no accident given our founder's DNA, we crafted the strategy that, with tweaks and upgrades, continues to serve us today, to help bring about change where change is most needed by investing in, connecting, and celebrating social entrepreneurs dedicated to solving the world's most pressing problems. I know you're expecting me to define a social entrepreneur, and I'm not going to disappoint you. I actually hope to convince you that social entrepreneurs play a distinctive role in driving societal progress, that they are to social change what business entrepreneurs are to economic progress. Both the concept and the practice of entrepreneurship has been around for hundreds of years, way, way before those paradigmatic Silicon Valley entrepreneurs came onto the scene. As early as the 16th century, the term was used to describe someone who undertakes a business venture. And by the 18th century, an Irishman who's considered to be the first economic theorist, one Richard Cantillon, characterized entrepreneurs as those who bear the risk of bringing an idea or an innovation to the marketplace. Social entrepreneurs, like entrepreneurs, are game changers. Joseph Schumpeter's famous paradox defines entrepreneurs as forces of creative destruction. We define social entrepreneurs as pioneers of innovations whose purpose is to benefit humanity. They're out to change the status quo, what Roger Martin, dean of the Rotman School of Business at the University of Toronto, and I have characterized as unjust societal equilibria. Equilibria that sustain human suffering, marginalization, and oppression, that hold people back from realizing decent lives and their full potential. Social entrepreneurs see opportunities where others see intractable problems. Fueled by the power of their visions, they assume the risk of building ventures, generally in the form of organizations, to drive those innovations forward. In both their ways of working and their zeal to effect that equilibrium change, social entrepreneurs are different from social service providers and social activists. Although some get started as providers or activists, and many integrate advocacy strategies in targeting specific policy reforms. I suspect most of the people in this room are worried about one or more problems out there. Some proportion of us may even have ideas about how to address them, but it's the rare human being who actually translates that idea to an innovation and builds the mechanism or a venture to carry it forward. The social entrepreneur's journey nearly always begins with an insight or inspiration, a challenge worth tackling, sometimes accompanied even by a personal tipping point, that existential moment when she puts to herself the big question, if not me, who? If not now, when? And then tasks herself with the business of designing the innovation and venture, often in the face of enormous skepticism, and summons inexhaustible funds of fortitude to drive into those headwinds. The social entrepreneurs we invest in at the Skoll Foundation are of this breed, and they're well on their way, having proven their models and arrived at an inflection point where they're poised to scale their solutions in a significant way. We select them, we provide core support to them in the form of an initial multi-year grant, and we connect them to their peers, media partners, funders, and others. To build the field of social entrepreneurship, though, we had to go beyond grant making and partnering with existing organizations. If we were to make the kind of impact on the enabling environment that we hoped to make, there was nothing to do but roll up our sleeves and build some new ventures ourselves. Today, those ventures that have played a significant role in bringing social entrepreneurship from the margins and into the mainstream include the Skoll Center for Social Entrepreneurship, now headed by my colleague Pamela Hartigan at Oxford University's Said Business School, Social Edge, our online community for social entrepreneurs, and one of the pioneers of Social Edge is right in that row there, Keely Stevenson, the Skoll World Forum, Paula Kravitz right there, heads up the Skoll World Forum for us, dubbed by its third year, the Davos of Social Entrepreneurship, and a suite of media products and partnerships with entities like Sundance, PBS's NewsHour, and the BBC that have led to 79 broadcast stories, 181 news reports for radio and podcast, not counting this one, and 12 feature-length documentary film projects. That this body of work has helped spawn more than 200 university and college programs around the world dedicated to social entrepreneurship, a steady increase in interest, references, and action among influencers in the media and policy realms, including the Obama administration's new Office of Social Innovation, and led to dramatic increases in awareness and funding from the philanthropic community, has made us proud, even as we acknowledge how much more there is to be done and tip our hats to other great players carrying this agenda forward. As for our direct engagement with social entrepreneurs, we've been on a remarkable journey over our first decade, learning a whole lot about their strengths and flaws, the design and stages of their ventures, and the habits of mind and strategies that are likely, over time, to make them successful. Along the way, we've kept faith with Jeff's vision to help bring about a more peaceful, prosperous, and sustainable world, and our mandate to go beyond grant-making and our work with social entrepreneurs, to connect them with opportunities and resources, and to celebrate who they are and the difference they make. To illustrate how this strategy has played out, let's go back to those two motorcyclists, Andrea and Barry Coleman. Their story begins in Donington Park, home of Britain's Motorcycle Grand Prix. For reasons that Barry, whose academic degree is in philosophy and whose first career as a journalist for, among others, The Guardian, Forbes, and the BBC, continues to puzzle over, that sport's racers initiated fundraising to support children in developing world countries and cared enough about the difference their efforts were making to travel themselves to Africa. What they experienced there shocked them. They heard from nurses unable to deliver health care to villages within 20 kilometers of a clinic. They saw women hemorrhaging from childbirth, transported in wheelbarrows. And they counted by the hundreds rusted vehicles abandoned on roadsides and motorcycles piled up at clinics for want of a $3 part. For people who knew about engines, none of this made any sense. For people who were raising funds to benefit suffering children, it was, in a word, insufferable. For several years in the 80s and 90s, Barry worked with agencies like Save the Children to develop systems to manage and maintain vehicles in harsh environments, testing and proving the model in partnership with Africans in Uganda, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, while Andrea focused on expanding global support in the motorcycling community for Africa's children. Over the 10 years between 1986 and 1996, they demonstrated the brilliance of Barry's TRM approach, Transportation Resource Management, increasing the efficiency of African health workers by more than 300%, dramatically reducing infectious disease incidence and mortality rates, and significantly strengthening African health ministry capacity and accountability. By the mid-90s, though, they were ready for independence, craving the autonomy and focus that is the entrepreneur's differentiator. Back to backwards and in high heels. Barry and Andrea were successful, well-educated people, but by no means wealthy themselves. To capitalize the venture and secure its autonomy, they couldn't reach into their own pockets, tap a circle of rich friends, or get a bank loan. And so they mortgaged their house. And in 1996, Riders for Health became a registered charitable organization in the UK. In 2005, we undertook due diligence on Riders, assessing it against our criteria, evaluating its entrepreneur founders, the significance of the issue it was evaluating, its track record, its inflection point, whether it was poised to scale its impact, and its readiness for what we had to offer. They came through with flying colors, and we brought the Colemans and Riders into our portfolio, honoring them with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship in early 2006, granting them $765,000 over 3 years for core support. So far, so good. But really just good progressive grant making. Not enough grant makers do core support, and that is a differentiator for us. But still, that's just good progressive grant making. The story gets more interesting as we get to know Barry and Andrea, and they get to know us. In 2008, they approached us with a plan to expand their work in the Gambia by transforming their model. Instead of managing an effective but modestly scaled NGO program in the Gambia, they were prepared to contract directly with the Gambian Ministry of Health to meet 100% of its transportation service need. But to do so, they would have to amass the capital necessary to purchase outright their fleet of vehicles. We could have just made a grant But Barry and Andrea were advancing a business model and sought financing. We could have made a program-related investment directly with riders, a program-related investment, or PRI, is a tool available to a private foundation. It's not a grant, but a market-based investment, usually debt or equity, made in support of the foundation's charitable purpose. And when made, it counts against payout. When paid back, it has to be credited against payout. But that would have missed another opportunity to strengthen the Gambia's institutional lending capacity. So what we did, and Richard Fahey's here, he manages our capital model and knows all about this work. What we did was deposit $2.2 million in a Gambian bank in Bangui to serve as a guarantee, thereby securing the deal. Guarantee Trust Bank Gambia then lent Riders the money to buy its fleet. The health ministry signed the contract, thereby providing the revenue needed for Riders both to deliver its service and repay its debt. But the real excitement here is that this deal is securing health care for the entire Gambian population, more than 2 million people, and proving that last-mile health delivery can be achieved consistently and sustainably over time. Last year, when we were approached by an organization to develop a series for distribution on the BBC, we naturally wanted to include Riders, and happily, the producers agreed. Supported by Rockhopper TV, entitled Alvin's Guide to Good Business, the series aired just this past April. Because Andrea and Barry are as strategic as they are telegenic, they seized upon the opportunity to use their star turn on the BBC with the Zambian Ministry of Health. 9 months into working in Zambia, they were still in the earliest stages of negotiating. Fast forward to the outcome. After screening the episode with ministry officials, they inked a memorandum of understanding in an unprecedented 9 days, the customary and usual negotiation with a new African country taking upwards of 2 years. And we're still not done. At the Skoll World Forum this past April, senior representatives of OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, were in the delegate audience for a session during which Andrea spoke. Hearing about Riders and its model, OPIC officials went straight up to her following the session and said, "We want to fund you." Another story that's fun to tell, which shows just how fraught with risk the social entrepreneur's path can be, is about Kiva, and you'll have Premal Shah here speaking, so you'll enjoy his story. It's a big success today, but it almost didn't make it through year one. The organization's bank account was heading toward empty in the fall of 2006 when Frontline World, with Skoll Foundation to support, to suss out, report on social entrepreneurs, did a story. The night it aired, which is actually Halloween, the organization's servers crashed due to traffic overload. 3 days later, when Kiva got back up, it was able to process more than $250,000 in new loans. Without that right intervention at the right moment, Kiva might not have made it, and certainly wouldn't have passed the 100 million mark as it did earlier this year. I tell you these stories not as an exercise in self-promotion. As a friend of mine liked to quip, self-congratulation can be habit-forming, and most organizations are long gone in addiction, but to bring our Invest, Connect, and Celebrate mission to life, and to shine a light on the overriding imperative for the Colemans as for the Skoll Foundation of impact. You might be noticing about now that I haven't once referenced that going-to-scale shibboleth so common in this sector. For us, as for most of the organizations we work closely with, and for thought leaders in this field, people like Greg Deese of Duke's Center for the Advancement of Social Entrepreneurship, the only scale that matters is that of impact. Elsewhere, I've argued that our concern with scale shouldn't focus on an organization's size or budget, but the scale of its impact, its ability to transform systems, right injustices, and demonstrate that it can solve seemingly intractable problems. This isn't to say that social entrepreneurs shouldn't grow their organizations, but only to restate my thesis that how big you are is in no way a measure or even a proxy of how good you are at driving change. Inevitably, though, questions of scale force us to consider numbers, what to count, and what that information tells us. At the risk of voicing yet another earnest caution about the role of metrics, let me admit straight out that numbers only get us so far on the proof of impact imperative. Think, for example, of one of the most famous acts of philanthropy ever, Andrew Carnegie's initiative to build public libraries carried out between 1886 and 1919 through a matching grant program. More than 2,500 libraries were built as a result of this effort, the first in Scotland, most in the United States, but also across England, Canada, and even in Fiji. Now, library buildings are easy to count, as are the books that fill them. Circulation data, how many people are checking out how many books, tells us a bit more, giving us information about how many people are using libraries and what they're reading. What's harder to measure is the arguably more important impact of those libraries on communities, whether their citizens are better educated and more informed due to the libraries in their backyard. Common sense tells us they are. Common sense also tells us that Carnegie's philanthropic intent was not simply to dot the landscape with libraries, but to ensure the people he believed to be a society's most industrious and ambitious and most capable of helping themselves were afforded the means to improve their lives and their communities. Doing the work we do, whether as social investors or social entrepreneurs, requires not just accountability systems, but what I'd call unapologetically common sense leaps of faith. For great philanthropists like Andrew Carnegie and Jeff Skoll, as for the great social entrepreneurs in the Skoll Foundation portfolio, empowering those with the greatest stake in benefiting themselves, their societies, and the larger world is fundamental to achieving large-scale impact. It may seem an obvious point, but it's not trivial. Enlisting, engaging, enrolling, and fully empowering individuals and communities written off by markets, ignored or marginalized by governments, and patronized as beneficiaries by NGOs is the very oxygen social entrepreneurs breathe. Beyond this fundamental way of working in respectful partnership with those they serve, social entrepreneurs, we found, are more likely to be successful in driving large-scale impact when they can clearly articulate an innovative solution to a pressing problem, when they punch above their weight by engaging strategic partners to scale their impact, when they align their revenue generation models with their missions, and when they build sound, sustainable organizations. Within the Foundation's portfolio, Amitabha Sadangi provides a great example. International Development Enterprises India, IDEI, helps turn subsistence farmers into income-generating producers via base-of-the-pyramid market products. Over the organization's 20-year history, its treadle pumps and customizable KB drip irrigation units have generated more than $1 billion in wealth, leading in turn to significant increases in health, education, and dignity for rural farm families. Beyond these direct impacts, Amitabha's work has also helped counter two interrelated and increasingly threatening trends, groundwater depletion and climate change. IDEI's products are 50 to 70% more efficient in their use of water than their competitors' offerings, while simultaneously boost crop yields by an impressive 50%. In addition, because IDEI's hand-powered pumps have displaced gas-driven pumps, they reduce carbon emissions. Typical of a social entrepreneur, Amitabha has seized on this measurable benefit to obtain carbon credits under the European Union's cap-and-trade system, bringing in additional revenues to support his work. IDEI, we believe, is doing for poor rural producers what Grameen did for poor borrowers, literally design-building the field of micro-irrigation. The Gates Foundation's recent decision to invest $27 million in IDEI to bring its model to Africa is just one more sign of the organization's growing impact. Mitch Besser and Jean Falk have led Mothers to Mothers, which works to halt pediatric AIDS transmission on a growth of impact trajectory that has the organization now reaching 1 in 5 pregnant women with HIV worldwide. Now, a 20% global market share of a target audience is a phenomenal achievement for any company. The more impressive in this case for being a market of expectant HIV-positive mothers who, when given the opportunity to be educated by their M2M-trained peers, can protect their babies from AIDS. Zaria Salti of Injaz al-Arab now reaches hundreds of thousands of students across the Middle East with life skills and entrepreneurship training, because she's been able to get entire public school systems to embrace her program. Ann Cotton's CAMFED, the Campaign for Female Education in Africa, has developed a community-based model so powerful that the hugely influential Linkletters International Law Firm is documenting its principles and strategies in order to influence how aid is deployed in the developing world. You get the picture. Amitabha, Jean and Mitch, Soraya and Anne are well on their way to achieving big impact. And in that process, they've taught us what it takes. Legions of empowered stakeholders, well-designed and effectively deployed models, evidence-based systems that track results, aligned resource engines, strategic partnerships that scale and leverage their impact, and organizations built to last. By now, you're probably thinking we've got this work nailed, that all we have to do is let those social entrepreneurs get to it. But let me assure you, it's early innings, the game far from over, definitive victory on any major front, the kind declared and justly celebrated in the 20th century for defeating scourges like yellow fever and smallpox, the Nazis, uncertain. Heading toward our 10th anniversary at the Skoll Foundation with Jeff's and the board's encouragement, we held up the mirror and asked ourselves whether we were doing enough, doing it well enough, or whether, in fact, social entrepreneurship was up to the formidable challenges confronting humanity and the planet. Just looking around, big problems like climate change or extremism seem to be getting worse, more complex, their implications far more frightening. But as a good friend of ours, Paul Hawken, has said, when asked if I am pessimistic or optimistic about the future, my answer is always the same. If you look at the science about what is happening on the Earth and aren't pessimistic, you don't understand the data. But if you meet the people who are working to restore this Earth and the lives of the poor, and you aren't optimistic, you haven't got a pulse. At the Skoll Foundation, we felt for that pulse, and it came up strong. Optimistic, no question about it, but not the flaccid, wide-eyed kind. Rather the sinewy, steely-eyed kind, what the Arctic explorer Ernest Shackleton meant when he defined optimism as courage. Preparing to go the distance with social entrepreneurs tackling the big issues of our time, poverty, food security, human rights, health, climate change, requires more than the easy bit of reaffirming our commitment to social entrepreneurs. We have to, we recognize, raise our game. So instead of seeing social entrepreneurs and their organizations as the be and end all of change making, we've taken to heart three of the lessons they've taught us. First, that strategic partners in business, civil society, and government are not nice to haves, but absolutely key to change making. Second, that while vested interests will always resist the forces of disruption, every ecosystem is fairly fizzing with allies, ready to help, but they need connecting and celebrating too. And finally, that to be a serious partner, we need to get off the sidelines and into the fray. In the near term, we've set ourselves the goals of getting a lot smarter about a set of priority issues, better networked with players in those issues, and clear about what we can do to help influence the changes in behavior, policy, and systems needed. Some of our partners are already in the Skoll family. Our colleagues at the Skoll Global Threats Fund, several of whom are here, participant media and Take Part, at Capricorn Investment Group, and on the Jeff Skoll Group team. This is the remarkable community of organizations Jeff has created to help bring about a better world. Several of my beloved brothers and sisters from these organizations and the foundation are here tonight. And believe me, we're seizing opportunities to unleash our collective impact, making darn sure Skoll social entrepreneurs focused on public education know about participants' upcoming documentary on the subject, Waiting for Superman, coming out in September. Tapping the global threats teams, knowledge networks, as we build out next year's program for the Skoll World Forum. Referring social entrepreneurs with game-changing business ventures to Capricorn, and much more. Many other partners are in the room tonight and listening on the radio. Thanks for being here, for tuning in, for doing what you do to make a difference. I don't think John Gardner knew the Colemans, but he might have had them and other great social entrepreneurs in mind when he wrote, "Life isn't a train ride where you choose your destination, pay your fare, and settle back for a nap. It's a cycle ride over uncertain terrain, with you in the cyclist seat, constantly correcting your balance and determining the direction of your progress." To Andrea and Barry Coleman, the the direction of their life's work has everything to do with making darn sure those motorcycles are those of theirs are also in fighting trim. They're oil-topped, tires on tight, engines firing on all cylinders. Because Andrea and Barry, like Paul Farmer and Ann Cotton and all great social entrepreneurs, are not on any old joyride, tooling along in the groove. They're on that cushion, braving the dust and the dirt, because that's where you have to head when you mean to win. And make no mistake about it, they're out to win, to transform healthcare delivery, to save millions of lives, and to prove what's possible. Thank you.
Our thanks to Sally Osberg, President and CEO of the Skoll Foundation, and a great inspiration to all of us. Now, I'm going to ask Sally to stay up there because there's quite a few questions, and I've tried to put them in some semblance of order. Essentially, the questions divvy up questions specifically about the Skoll Foundation and questions about the field of social entrepreneurship. So let me start first with the field and then move to the foundation. One of the characteristics that's often cited about social entrepreneurship is that it blurs the demarcation between profit and nonprofit. I wonder if you could speak to how important is business to the social entrepreneurship model. And is it an absolute criteria in order to be a so is business acumen, skills, or even profit making aspects integral to being a social entrepreneur?
I don't think so. I think the skills are imperative. You have to be disciplined. You have to be focused. You have to know what you're doing. You have to build a venture. You have to run it responsibly. You have to be accountable. No question about that. Whether that's a business skill or that's just plain strategic focus and smarts, I couldn't really tell you. We at the Skoll Foundation see social enterprise, which is the term that's usually used to describe a profit-making concern that has a social objective, as a subset of social entrepreneurship and not the other way around. So for us, the model that serves the purpose, the model that serves the mission is what's relevant here. You know, I don't want to confuse the model for the imperative. The goal here is to create social value, to crack the code on a problem, to make a difference for humanity. If you have to do that with a nonprofit venture, fine. Do it with a nonprofit venture. If it makes sense to do it as a business venture, do it as a business venture. It's really the goal that matters, the focus, the discipline, the drive, the ability to stay with something. That's what distinguishes the social entrepreneur, regardless of whether it's a for-profit or nonprofit venture.
Okay, thank you. There's a number of questions about specific issue areas. So the ones that we've gotten are environmental, healthcare, microfinance, and journalism as areas in which there are social entrepreneurs. And the questions are, how do you see those fields evolving and your role within them?
Well, we have an issues framework we use at the foundation, and in fact, all the organizations in the Jeff Skoll Group family use the same mega issue framework. We have an acronym that we use. We call it the PIE. It's tolerance and human rights. It's health, economic and social equity, peace and security, institutional responsibility, and environmental sustainability. And what you're hearing are those issues described as positives. So within each of those issues are a whole bunch of subsets. You know, economic and social equity obviously is huge. So education, girls' education, a lot of those issues precipitate out from that. Microfinance is a tool for addressing poverty and giving people the tools they need to lift themselves out of poverty. So those issues actually are subsets. We're trying to look for the intersection of the pressing problem and the promising solution. So I don't think we have any social entrepreneurs in journalism. I know they're out there. We have worked with social entrepreneurs using media tools to advance their programs. An organization, wonderful social entrepreneurs, John and Susan Marks, created an organization called Search for Common Ground that uses that creates soap operas, really, to address issues of conflict resolution and so on. So they're using media. We don't have any working in journalism. We have a number working in the health arena besides Writers for Health and Mothers to Mothers. We also worked with Victoria Hale, who created One World Health, which was the world's first nonprofit pharmaceutical company. So we have a number of folks working in those areas. But we're really after that intersection of the pressing problem and the promising solution. And so we're not agnostic, because we're saying, is this a big problem? And is this solution really... does it have the potential to scale impact in a significant way so you can start to shift that equilibrium? Great example of a social entrepreneur who was able to do that. Probably most of you have heard of or know of Paul Farmer and his incredible work with Partners in Health. In the 80s, there was a real epidemic in the shanty towns of Lima of multi-drug-resistant TB, and the World Health Organization at that time really refused to commit the medication and staff the folks to be able to address this. So Paul and his colleagues went out to prove that it could be done, and, by God, they proved it. They proved with their accompagnateur model that you could bring the TB infection rates down by 83%. Now, this was an achievement that got everybody's attention, because this is actually more successful than developed world treatments for multi-drug resistant TB. And with that, he was able to convince then the WHO. They revised their policies, and now hundreds of thousands of people are getting this treatment. So that's an example of how the social entrepreneur and the pressing problem, the promising solution, and that's the sweet spot we're looking at.
There's a couple of questions wondering if you believe that microfinance has achieved its potential. Has microfinance truly scaled where it's being used?
I think microfinance is absolutely, absolutely scaling. No question about it. And the fact that, the fact that the Compton-Thomases of the world and so on are adopting it, and you have these, what are perceived to be extortionist rates. You have, have major funds that have been developed. You have interest in the capital markets and microfinance, products. That's all evidence that this is scaled. But some of you have heard Eunice talk, and, for Eunice, as for me, I'm still a real idealist at heart. You don't reap profits on the backs of poor people. This is about benefiting them and the impacts that matter, in addition to repayment, which has been kind of the sine qua non of microfinance, is whether, they're able to send their children to school. Do they have food? Do they, can they vaccinate their kids? These are the questions. And there's the fact that there's controversy about microfinance now, I think, is a real healthy sign. Jonathan Lewis is there. He can talk about microfinance if you want to look him up. He's much more knowledgeable than I. But when I look at the controversy that's sort of swirling around microfinance now, I think of Gandhi, who said, first they ignore you, then they mock you, then they fight you, and then you win. It's a good sign. It's a good sign.
So one person in the audience would like to know if there's a particular area or subject area in which you feel that social entrepreneurship has not taken hold effectively and you wish it would.
Gee, that's a really good question. I don't know. I think social entrepreneurs are everywhere. I don't think we're, if there's an area they're not working where they should, I don't know about it. And Ruth mentioned that I come from the museum field. Well, I didn't know this when I was in You know, when I was still in college and doing internships at the Boston Children's Museum, I was working for a great social entrepreneur, Mike Spock, who was the, you know, son of Benjamin Spock, but he was reinventing the museum. And museums have been transformed over the last, you know, 25, 40 years. And so they are now places that, you know, welcome children and communities and engage them in the educational programming. So, you know, social entrepreneurs are working in the arts. They're working in, you know, they're working on health issues. They're working on issues of poverty. They're working on issues of equity, human rights. They're, you know, they're working everywhere that it's important. But that's a good question. You know, I'll have to think about that some more.
All right. Feel free to get back to us on that. Okay. Next question is about social entrepreneurs themselves. I think we've got some aspiring social entrepreneurs in the audience. What advice would you give to someone who has an idea but doesn't know quite how to move forward?
Oh, gosh. My advice is, you know, apprentice yourself. Get, you know, create the networks and the opportunities for yourself to get a little smarter about how to build the venture, how to build the network, how to lead, and how to be good for the long pull. Because this isn't for the, you know, this isn't easy. This takes real perseverance, and lots more people are going to say no before someone says yes. So, you know, build up your hide so that when you do start, when you know you have to, and you go there, you're going to be good for the. You're going to be good for the long haul. So get some experience, build some networks, learn a little bit about what it takes, and, you know, care enough for yourself to put yourself in a place where you're more likely to be successful.
Okay. One of the characteristics that's often cited when talking about a social entrepreneur is that tenacity that you just mentioned, and the ability to continuously pull rabbits out of hats that you didn't even know existed. I wonder if you can look across your frame of reference is so wide and you know so many people. Can you tell us a couple of examples of people or about their tenacity and the ability to pull rabbits out of hats?
Rabbits out of hats. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether I'd actually call it rabbits out of hats. I would say that it's more about not being willing to cede defeat. And I'll give you just one example of you know, I mentioned Victoria Hale. I told you a little bit about the Institute for One World Health. There was a picture of her up there. You know, Victoria is a really remarkable social entrepreneur. But One World Health ended up, you know, going through some tough times, and she ended up leaving. Well, you know, she could have gone back into her corner and sulked and skulked and, you know, blamed whoever for the collapse of the organization and the institution that she was building. But she didn't. She's on to her next venture. And she's found new investors. She's, you know, she's smarter, she's wiser, she's more resilient, and she's gonna, you know, I'll bet on her. I bet on her any day. She cares too much about this work as a pharmaceutical scientist herself. She can't accept the fact that there are readily available drugs in the developed world, and orphan diseases in the developing world, that children still die of diarrhea. She's going to do something about it. So failure, you know, they can look failure in the face, and they can keep going. And she's a wonderful example and a real inspiration.
Okay, that's a good one. It's not that hard, relatively, to look at problems in developing countries from a developed country perspective and think about solutions in developing countries. The needs are so great. But social entrepreneurship is also taking off in the developed world. Can you speak, are there differences between social entrepreneurship in the developed world versus the developing, and if so, what are they?
Oh, gosh. I don't think the social entrepreneurs are no different. We have a portfolio of 81 social entrepreneurs, 66 organizations, 81 individuals, and they are, they're Africans and Indians and Latin Americans and Americans, and they recognize each other. They're cut out of the same cloth, and they're different ages, and they're different backgrounds. And some of them come from very poor backgrounds, and some of them come from very elite backgrounds. But they are, their profile is you just recognize them. They're smart. They're strategic. They're determined. They're focused. They're good for the long pull. The difference, I would say, is in their networks. A lot of the developing world social entrepreneurs access funds from aid organizations, from the Norwegians or the Japanese. They're able to tap into those development funds. And in the U.S., a lot of the social entrepreneurs have access to the high net worth networks. So some of the ways they manage the capital raise is a little different. But they're recognizable in terms of their profile. They really are.
Is there a difference between those trying to solve problems in developed countries, social entrepreneurs that are focusing on problems within the United States versus those that are focusing on problems within Africa, for example?
One of the differences that's kind of obvious is that a lot of the social entrepreneurs working in the developing world are working on issues of food productivity and food security, agricultural productivity. They're in rural environments, and they're trying to secure the food necessary to feed their families and then increase their productivity on these smallholder plots that they manage. I don't see that much in the U.S. In the U.S., the social entrepreneurs are working more on education and the issues of inequity in the cities. So maybe they're a little more urban in their focus in the developed world and a little more rural in their focus. And so much of the challenge in the developing world is around the transportation systems and access. The infrastructure isn't there. So that creates challenges. Riders for Health is a response to just plain infrastructure deficiency. Mm-hmm. But then there are sometimes I think that infrastructure deficiency, maybe not when it comes to roads and transportation, but eventually it's going to be a benefit. If I look at, the way mobile telephony took off in the developing world, it took off because you didn't have that vested interest of the, of copper. You could just leapfrog right over. And my hope as I think about this generation of entrepreneurs coming out of engineering schools and business schools, bringing, new technologies, solar technologies and renewable technologies to market, that, the developing world and the social entrepreneurs there may just leapfrog right over what we're doing in this country.
Okay, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the foundation itself. You describe very eloquently an organic organization. Skoll seems to have incorporated learning and evolved throughout its relatively short life, and that seems to be really part of your DNA. So there's questions about, one, how you do that, how you constantly reevaluate what you're doing, and two, where do you think that evolution is taking the Skoll Foundation?
Well, absolutely, we are organic. Jeff Skoll, one of the things that was really brilliant about creating the Skoll Foundation that I don't get to talk about much, that I really want to just put a pin in here, is that, it didn't start with $4 billion, transferred over, okay, go fix the world. Jeff says that he started the foundation on the installment plan. So he, there was an initial gift of stock in 1999 when, after eBay went public, and he built the foundation over time. So there have been steady infusions of capital, and the chance for really for us to grow into what it meant to be a foundation, what it means to evolve a strategy, what it means to create these programs, what it means to create these partnerships and to learn as we went. You know, we started out with, before I got there were 9 issue areas, you know, then we honed it to 4, and then we created the issue framework, and then we decided it was social entrepreneurs as a cross-cutting theme, but then there was so much continuity, too. You know, right from the beginning, it was look for these special people who have what it takes to drive the change. So a lot of organic change and evolution, and then a lot of continuity. You know, we created the Skoll Center, the Skoll World Forum. We've stayed with them. They've gotten better and better and better each year, and we keep setting the bar higher for ourselves because we see the opportunity. You know, we like to think that as a foundation, we think and act a whole lot more than a social entrepreneur, than a philanthropic organization. And that's not to be critical of philanthropy. You know, philanthropy is a great thing and a great privilege, but we want to bring that social entrepreneur's discipline and resourcefulness to what we do and the way we do it. So we're constantly learning, evaluating ourselves, critiquing ourselves, setting the bar higher, because we think we can do it better. We can learn. We can make more of a difference and hold ourselves accountable for that difference.
I wrote a recent blog for the Stanford Social Innovation Review in which I said that I walked down University Avenue in Palo Alto, and I randomly asked 10 people what the definition of social entrepreneurship was. And 7 of them thought it was some kind of business on Facebook. The people in this room understand the concept, but one of the goals of the Skoll Foundation is to increase awareness of this term and the tools that people, entrepreneurs, can use to affect change. How would you say you are doing on that, and what still needs to be done?
You know, I think we've done pretty well on that. And we weren't out to really, you know, make sure that, you know, 10 out of 10 people on University Avenue could give you the Sally Osberg and Roger Martin definition of a social entrepreneur. What we wanted to do was get to the influencers. What we wanted to do was get to the folks with the power and the money. Because what we saw was a whole raft of extraordinary people doing amazing work. And if ever there were folks who should merit investment, it was they. And so we were trying to get to those influencers. And I think we've done pretty well. Just that little Kiva story, you know, getting them on Frontline World. There's a wonderful story about IDE India on the NewsHour. I think we've done pretty well. Willie Foote, we did a little film on Root Capital that actually we screened at the Skoll World Forum. We made sure Starbucks was there because we have our delegate targets for the Skoll World Forum, so we know we have people from, you know, companies and philanthropy and different sectors, civil society, et cetera. So Starbucks sees this film, and they go bananas, you know, literally they go bananas. And they say they want to screen it in their stores. And by the way, they want to invest in Willie. So, you know, you put together those folks and you try to get to them. That's the kind of marketing we try to do. Identify the influencers, the audiences, and speak to them because they can, you know, they have the power, they have the money. They can help fuel this amazing work social entrepreneurs do.
There's a question about how much you help the organizations and the entrepreneurs once you find them. How much coaching do you do? Is it just handing over the money, or are you an ongoing partner? And if you're an ongoing partner, can you describe how that partnership works?
Well, our mission is to drive large-scale change by investing in, connecting, and celebrating social entrepreneurs and other innovators dedicated to solving the world's most pressing problems. So investing, connecting, and celebrating goes well beyond transactional philanthropy. It's not just the check, although the social entrepreneurs really value that core support. just one example of something we do. As I said, we convene the Skoll World Forum every year in Oxford. But we also design a whole convening just for our community of social entrepreneurs. So we work with them to identify areas of need and interest for them, whether it's in talent development or, you know, board development or fundraising or branding or whatever it is, and we'll produce workshops to meet those needs. So we, you know, some things we try to create sort of a solution across the community, and sometimes we're working very individually with the social entrepreneurs on a specific challenge they might have or a specific need, a specific opportunity. We have, for example, Gary White of water.org is going to be, Matt Damon is a movie star. So Matt Damon is also part of water.org, and they want to do a little event at the foundation. We'll work with them on that. So that's, you know, lots of little things like that. But trying to introduce them to the right people, connect them with resources, be there as sounding boards for them, and then, you know, we make films for them, we plug them into our Sundance partnership, we, you know, put them on the stage at the Skoll World Forum, we introduce them to the Lehrer NewsHour so that they can, you know, they may show up there with a story. We do a fair amount. And then there were those stories I told, the writer's example, where we can do the PRI, where, you know, we can do media work with them, just a whole suite of services. But it's bespoke for the most part. It has to do with what they need and what we have and where the opportunity intersection lies.
And do you find that those the help and the coaching that you give in any way differs between those operating within authoritarian regimes versus more democratic nations?
I don't think so. Sakina Yacoubi, for example, in Afghanistan is she's an amazing, inspiring social entrepreneur. But she's wrestling with the Taliban. I mean, I can't really help there. All I can do is support her as a human being and the work she does, introduce her to the right people, be there for her. And, you know, when she needed some help after the volcano stranded us all in Oxford, we helped her get her plane ticket to the U.S. So, you know, we take care of our folks, too.
There's a number of people who are worried that with the economic downturn, there'll be less funding for social entrepreneurship. Is that something that you see? And I don't know what I don't want to ask about Jeff Skoll's portfolio, but have you been affected by the economic turn?
Yeah. Oh yeah, like most foundations, we took a big hit. We took a big hit, and we had to get more resourceful. We had to decide what was core, what was most important, and really focus our resources there. But those, the pain was shared across the board, and the opportunity really is to become more clear about what you're doing, the difference you're trying to make, and maybe have to let go of some things that are more tangential. But it happened to everybody, almost everybody, and we weathered it.
It's the time for our last question, and because I know you're up to the task, Sally, I'm not going to give you a softball question.
Thanks, Ruth. This is a woman who's just back from India, so she's...
there are several people who want to know what you personally think is the world's most pressing problem.
Oh, gosh. I'm a generalist. I think they are interconnected. You tell me if we can really separate climate change from poverty, from the oppression of women. You know, it's from the future we all want for our children. I think these problems are interconnected. It's one of the reasons I love working with social entrepreneurs. They're working across all of those. You can talk about climate justice and you can talk about climate change. Guess what? They're related. They're related. The fate of the Bangladeshis, the fate of people who are going to be suffering, the fate of the social entrepreneurs whose lift is going to be so much heavier because of climate change, that affects me, that affects you, that affects all of us. And, you know, I like what Paul Farmer and Paul Hawken have said. You can't really separate environmentalism and sustainability and social justice. We all have to get on the bus.
Our thanks to Sally Osberg for this talk and all your important work. We also want to thank you, our audience, here at the Commonwealth Club on radio, television, and the internet. Today's program has been the third in the Commonwealth Club's social entrepreneurship series. I want to thank our donors. Let me just mention one first. The Skoll Foundation, the Omidyar Network, and the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming tonight. I'm Ruth Shapiro, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.